You're listening to 42 Macros Pro to Pro Live, hosted by Darius Dale.
Howdy, Team 42. It's your skipper here, Darius Dale, to present another episode of Pro to Pro Monthly. I'm joined with our friend Peter Bookvar over at Bleakley Financial Group. How are you doing today, Peter?
Darius, great to see you.
It's wonderful to see you, man. So last time I saw you, we were both attending CNBC's Delivering Alpha Conference. Really awesome event. I want to thank those guys for inviting us. What was your sort of key takeaway from that day?
Well, I thought the AI thing was pretty cool with Andrew and David Faber. I think Sarah Eisen had a good interview with Nelson Peltz. So it was good to hear people like that in person and off, sort of off the cuff. And it's always an interesting day, good day of networking as well. Getting a chance to meet you in person for the first time is a perfect example.
Yeah, likewise, man. Appreciate you. It was awesome to see you. So for those folks who have been sleeping under a really comfortable rock, can you give us a little background about yourself and what you guys are trying to do for your clients over at Bleakley Financial?
Sure. So we're a pretty conventional private wealth management firm with a variety of different clients, from young to old to wealthy to wannabe wealthy, business owners, institutions, and so on. And trying to both hold their hands with respect to their portfolios and do other financial planning type stuff. I'm solely focused on the investment side. I manage two portfolios here. One's a global macro and one's focused on income, but also run the investment committee and trying to get our clients in investments that I find attractive. One of the benefits of having this type of clientele is, it sort of extends your time horizon. So it at least helps me avoid a lot of the paying attention to everything that goes on a daily basis, but allow investment themes sort of to play out and not to get sort of bogged down in anything that's happening short term.
Yeah, 100%. And I think we're all guilty of that, and certainly in today's modern, hyper-financialized, hyper-media-covered world, there's just, there's so much going on Twitter every day, so much going on LinkedIn. Obviously, we got our legacy financial media sources, our non-traditional financial media sources, of which this is one of them. So there's a lot of noise out there. This may be noise as well. I don't purport to say everything I say.
No, it's when I say that, it's, there's so much stuff going on. I'm just trying to close my email so we don't keep hearing beeps. I pay attention to everything. One of the things that, I think to be sort of a complete investor, it's important to pay attention both to the micro and the macro. Mm-hmm. And, like even a Warren Buffett, for example, says, oh, don't pay attention to the macro. But he owns a big position in Oxy, for example. Mm-hmm. He's got to pay attention to the price of oil. He owns one of the largest railroad businesses in the U.S. Okay. He's got to pay attention to the macro because he's shipping coal and he's shipping grains and autos. So anybody who tells me I don't pay attention to the macro, I don't think is being straightforward. It's important to merge the macro with the micro, whether you have a long-term time horizon, a short-term trading time horizon. I think it's good to have everything going on in your head that you can then distill in terms of what will benefit your investment process.
100%, man. I couldn't agree more. I think, just as important as it is, in my opinion, of paying attention to both the macro and the micro, is having a, real durable framework for, putting those two things together. Because it's one thing to just pay attention to a lot of things, obviously. It's another thing to actually create signal out of the information that we're consuming on a daily basis. And it sounds like you guys are doing a pretty good job of that for your clients over at Bleakley.
We try. And also what flows through that macro that affects the micro being, obviously company specific stuff. And since we own a bunch of stocks and, we go through a lot of earnings calls to get that micro color. But, what the Fed does matters. And what they do comes from the macro, but it flows into where markets go and where liquidity is and so on. So I think it's important to be sort of a complete investor, is putting all these things together and connecting as many dots as you can.
100%. Love the dot connect. That's my favorite part of the job, is connecting the dots. All right. So speaking of connecting the dots, that's a great segue to kind of opening up the conversation. What's your 30,000 foot worldview, specifically focusing on things that may probably be a little bit non-consensus at this particular juncture, or maybe even be consensus? What's the day one, you're meeting a client for the first time, they ask you, okay, what do you think about the world right now? What are you telling them?
So I'll start with the U.S. and I'll span out globally. What I see in the U.S. economy, to start there, is a very mixed and bifurcated U.S. economy, with areas of strength and definite areas of weakness. And while the headline GDP number has been running, call it 2.5-ish, 3%, I think that sort of masks a lack of clarity underneath the surface. And just to give some examples, you take the U.S. consumer, and we know that higher income consumers that are benefiting not only from a job, but have stock portfolios that have gone up in value substantially the last couple of years. If they own a home, the price of that is up 50% on average over the past 4 years. And they're spending, you know, they're prioritizing spend on more leisure, hospitality, travel, and so on, and less so goods because they spent a lot of money on them during COVID, but that is in a huge part of what is driving economic activity. But then on the other end of the consumer spectrum, you have the lower to middle income consumer that has been much more reserved with their spending. They've been much more focused on needs instead of wants, prioritizing how they allocate their extra dollar, and focused on value and convenience were the two most common words that I heard, particularly value, in all the retail, restaurant, conference calls that I listened to, you know, over the past couple of months. Then within other parts of the economy, have anything related to government spending that's certainly shrunk, particularly healthcare via Medicare, Medicaid payments to the whole system. And then you also have, of course, legislatively generated economic activity, whether that's infrastructure, the CHIPS Act, the IRA, and all the activity that's taking place, whether it's building manufacturing facilities and all the sort of the ancillary economic activity that comes from that. But then the manufacturing side of the U.S. economy, and globally too, has been in a recession for north of 2 years. Totally. Take the housing market. You have existing home sales that, in terms of pace of transactions, hovering near 30-year lows, which also negatively impacts all the things that take place around the transaction of a home, whether that is paint and flooring and carpet and a real estate agent, and, you know, any other renovations that take place when there's turnover of a house. But then you hear, like Toll Brothers, which obviously has a more affluent customer, that the new build market is doing better than the existing home market. But even within the new build market, you have the bigger builders that are taking market share from the smaller ones. And then to sort of wrap this up, well, let me add one more thing. Global trade, relatively muted. But then you look at the labor market, that's also mixed too. You have the pace of firings, relatively muted if we look at initial jobless claims, but the pace of hirings has slowed down in a variety of different metrics. So I think all in all, I think people should look under the hood of that headline GDP to sort of get a better feel of things. Oh, I forgot one more thing.
I love it.
Anything related to, of course, and I'm stating the obvious here, AI spend is doing great. When you have the big hyperscalers spending $15 to $20 billion a quarter, well, they're beneficiaries of that spend. But then on the other hand, if you look at capital spending, even within tech and broadly speaking, if you look at the non-defense capital goods ex-aircraft data, it's been flatlining for a couple of years now. So capital spending ex that AI hasn't really done much. So all in all, enough to confuse us on getting a clear picture. But the case is also global. You look at Europe, Germany and France are not seeing any growth, and Germany's probably seeing a slight contraction. But you have Spain and Greece benefiting from tourism that's outperforming its bigger peers. You look at Asia, China's obviously slowing down, but India is growing 7%. So there are a lot of pushes and pulls here that I think it's important to sort of slice and dice when you're looking at the global economy.
That was awesome, Peter. You just went through, like, you know, 80 slides of research and, like, you know, like a 5-minute presentation, and it lets me know that you are rolling up your sleeves, and your clients, your team over at Bleakley are doing the research to understand a lot of these dynamics. You know, if I can summarize what I think I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like we're operating as investors in a world full of divergences. You have divergences between, so obviously we have this robust headline growth number in the US, But you diverge that, you sort of juxtapose that with the flagging growth statistics that we're continuing to see out of places like Europe and China. You think about the growth, robust growth number in the U.S., and there's divergences within the U.S. economy. There's divergences between the upper income consumers and upper folks who are in the upper part of the wealth distribution relative to the low income consumers and lower part of the wealth distribution in terms of their activity, consumption activity. You also have a divergence between services and manufacturing and trade. You also have a divergence between pockets of the economy that are supported by more sort of secular tailwinds, such as infrastructure investment from the government or just government-sponsored investment to begin with, and or AI development relative to everything else that's probably, you know, pretty much flagging as well. So, you know, if that's a reasonable synopsis of what we are, what your general take is on the world, my number one question is how does one position for all these push pulls, right? Because it's hard to create a defensible portfolio when you have so much going on, unless of course you're playing the factor long short game.
Well, yeah, no, it does sort of confuse when it comes to the markets. But interestingly, when you look at, even going back to last year when the market had a good year, but it was even within the stock market, it was very bifurcated. Right. It was the same case going into July. And I'll define why July in a second, where it was obviously the market's focus on a lot of the big names that we all know, where small mid-cap stocks were sort of just left for dead. And, you know, during the year, while this was, you know, further unfolding in the sense of this wide discrepancy between areas of the market, you know, I kept saying to myself, okay, the market's buying all these big names, Amazon and Meta and Google and so on, and Microsoft and NVIDIA, a whole AI trade. Now, NVIDIA was unique in the sense that almost half their customer base were those other big names.
Oh, yeah.
But those other big names are reliant on the rest of the economy. Like I would say, like, we all breathe the same economic air. So if you're Microsoft and you need to grow your business by selling new Office 365s to people that are getting new jobs and getting new seats, and, you know, as part of your business, well, how can Microsoft stock continue to go up like this while small, medium-sized companies that are a huge chunk of your customer base, their stocks are going like this?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was just something unsustainable, because either all these companies were going out of business, which would be negative for Microsoft, or their stocks were just suffering just because of rotation, and they would have to rebound to sort of substantiate Microsoft being where it was, you know, right, to use Microsoft as an example. And Meta and Google, that are hugely reliant on advertising, well, who does a lot of advertising on their platforms? Small, medium-sized companies.
Oh, yeah.
So the reason why I highlight July is because mid-July is when we got Q2 earnings. And actually, in the few weeks leading into it, you started to get some papers out there, whether it was from Goldman, I think there were a few others, where people started to question, okay, AI is this great thing, generative AI, because AI has been around for 75 years, but generative AI, the current iteration of it, can do all these incredible things down the road, but okay, show me the money, in the sense of, okay, all these companies are spending a lot. Now investors started to question what will be the revenue benefits from all this spend. So in middle of July, when we got hyperscaler numbers, I think these questions started to be asked. And then all of a sudden, luckily, for the rest of us that own other stocks in addition to the big names, that the market started to wake up to the fact that there are another 493 stocks out there. There's another 2,000 in the Russell. There's a bunch in the mid-cap that, hey, you know, again, we all breathe the same economic air. And you can't have this level of divergence to such an extreme with, again, one being the customer of another. So that's sort of has brought us to today, where we have seen other parts of the market that have participated to the upside. But, you know, going into July, when you were not owning those big names, or you just owned less, or you owned a bunch of the others that just weren't performing, finally things started to make a bit of sense. But now that a lot of things have now rallied in the U.S. Going into 2025, then it's just going to confuse us all again, and whether it's sustainable, whether any underperformance in big cap tech can hand a baton off to the rest of the market that can then run with it, or is the market just overvalued everywhere and we need to take a breather and we need to start asking questions.
Ooh, I love that. That's a hot take, my friend. Or a question that lends itself to several hot takes. Before we sort of open that Pandora's box, Colin, if you throw slide 27 on the screen, because I do want to illustrate a great point that Peter makes, in my opinion. And I think it sounds like your clients benefited from the anticipation of the broadening out of the market. You recognize that all these companies breathe the same economic air. And ultimately you said, okay, well, if investors are going to start to divest or at the bare minimum reduce their exposure to what has obviously been a very aggressive overweight in the Mag 7 type names, which is exactly what we saw this summer. We had a pretty meaningful correction in the NASDAQ. But that meaningful correction in the NASDAQ came alongside a positive price performance on a both absolute and relative basis on things like small caps. We saw the market broaden out. The cyclical defensive ratio broadened out to bullish. High beta, low beta ratio has since broke back out to bullish. And then now we're even seeing the small cap, mega cap ratio break out to bullish. So, you know, when you think about this from a market internals perspective, the market has come around to what it sounds like was your view that, you know, in order for this sort of, you know, Mag 7, you know, party to continue, we need to let more entrants into the into the club, so to speak. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was also one other pretty important macro factor that sort of gave the rest of the market some tailwind to it, was the Fed cutting rates by 50 basis points. Right. You know, when you think about a lot of two main pressure points to a lot of small, medium-sized companies was the very sharp rise in inflation in terms of their cost structure. They have obviously less ability relative to big names to absorb a very sharp rise in the cost of goods and labor and so on, but also the big pressure point of financing costs. You know, a lot of these small companies, they borrow SOFR plus. And when SOFR jumps 550 basis points in 18 months, you know, that becomes pretty painful because not all these companies are hedging out this floating rate debt exposure. I mean, we owned a couple of stocks whose interest expense doubled because these companies got too cute thinking that rates would stay low forever. And it wasn't until they started to rise well into the rise that they finally decided to, through swaps, hedge out that interest rate exposure. But they definitely got singed by the sharp rise in interest expense. So when the Fed started to cut 50 basis points, people said, okay, finally, that SOFR plus, we've reached the limit of pain. Now the Fed can give us some relief and our financing costs can go down, inflation further decelerating. We can at least take away those two pain points. And I think that also was a catalyst. It wasn't just, you know, okay, let's rotate for rotate's sake. You know, I think that was one of the more fundamental catalysts in addition to what I mentioned of investors finally questioning the sustainability of the growth rates of the big cap tech names.
No, it's great. I love it. I love how you connect the dots there. I definitely agree with you on the bifurcation in terms of financing structures for most corporate companies. I mean, if you're a large cap corporate company, you're borrowing almost exclusively in the bond market, where it's not SOFR plus, it's 10-year treasury yield plus.
Right, exactly.
It's a lot lower price than SOFR plus.
But interestingly, those companies, those investment grade companies, and even some in high yield, the higher for longer interest rate theme hasn't played out yet, because a lot of those companies that termed out their debt did so pre-2022.
100%.
At interest rates that were lower. So the maturity wall, now, at least for investment grade, we're not worried about these companies being able to refinance. They will. But the interest expense could be 100, 200 basis points above the interest rate on the loan coming due. Now, those companies will be fine, but we have to understand that looking back the last 15 years, one of the main drivers of profit margin expansion was low interest expense. So that low interest expense over the next couple of years will continue to mean revert in this higher rate environment that we're in, assuming it stays this way.
Yeah. I mean, in our view, it's very likely to stay this way for a variety of reasons. We still are, I want to say, among the high on the street at this point. A lot of folks have caught up to us in terms of our growth expectations and where we see nominal growth headed and trending over the next 12 months. So it's very likely what you just said, it comes true. We will have a refinancing cycle amongst the larger cohorts in corporate America into the higher interest rate regime, and that could create some problems in asset markets, or at the bare minimum, just create a slowing down of the broader economic.
Yeah, maybe earnings growth is not as robust. We know that the main driver of earnings, as I said, has been profit margin expansion relative to revenue growth. So just something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, 100%. So a couple things. First, going back to this conversation about terming out the debt, one of the things we keep track of are some of the balance sheet dynamics for both the household and corporate sector. Going back to a couple of years ago, back in the summer of 2022, we sort of kind of stumbled upon this just by nature of doing our research process every day and every month to produce these macro scouting report presentations. And we recognized that, okay, this is probably the most pristine balance sheet that we've ever seen in corporate America, not maybe ever, but certainly in the last couple of generations. If you look at corporate cash, household checkable or corporate checkable deposits and money market fund exposure, we're just shy of $3 trillion, up from essentially two prior to the pandemic. You see the corporate debt to nominal GDP ratio, it's elevated at 77%, but it's been declining this entire business cycle, which means that we've been growing the economy faster than corporates have accumulated leverage. And part of that reason is that we've have a tremendously low amount of exposure to things like floating rate debt at only 32% of the total, from a long run mean of a close to 40% and a high of roughly 60%. And when you sort of put these three things together on top of a robust economy, you're still talking about a corporate debt service ratio that is only at 41%. You're talking about 45, 46% heading into the prior two business cycle downturns. And so, I think we sort of agree that there is a level of robustness in the corporate sector balance sheet that has contributed to the resiliency of the economy. I think we both agree that there is that level of robustness in the corporate sector balance sheet is probably going to deteriorate at the margins throughout 2025, if only because we refinance into a higher level of debt growth, of lagged debt growth. And in fact, I have a very fun chart to show on that, which would kind of transition to our 2025 discussion. One of my favorite charts in macro is sort of a piggybacking on our mutual friend, Rob Paul's everything code analysis, which shows his analysis identified that the lagged growth rate of global debt has historically been a multi-year leading indicator for global liquidity, the fluctuations in the global liquidity cycle. And what we've also found, repeating that analysis and expanding upon that analysis is that, yes, that is true. It has historically been a leading indicator for the global liquidity cycle, but there are times where it just is not a leading indicator. And those times when it is not a leading indicator, we typically have significant problems in asset markets, specifically the GFC, when we had a significant divergence between the lagged growth rate. This is a 4.5-year lag here to kind of simulate the early wave of the refinancing cycle, global refinancing cycle. We had the GFC in terms of that big divergence. We had the 2011 European sovereign debt crisis when we had a big divergence there. We had a big divergence in 2015, 16, right around the China deval. We had a 14-15% correction, back-to-back 15% corrections in the stock market. Q4 18, obviously everybody remembers that crash. 2022, I'm sure everyone remembers that crash. And so my concern, if we think about the refinancing wall that is growing and accelerating to a very aggressive degree over the next few quarters, will this create more problems in asset markets than I think the sort of resiliency of the economy and the robustness of household and corporate sector balance sheets implies? What's your take on this?
So, well, let's break that down. Let's look at earnings to start out. I mentioned, we're talking about interest expense possibly stepping up as a lot of this debt gets refinanced. Let's also understand that this year, in 2024, if you look at FactSet data, all except a tiny percentage, I think, of the 493 stocks in the S&P, their earnings growth rate this year is 2%.
Yep.
The seven growth rate, I think, is like 40-something percent. So all of the earnings growth is happening with those seven stocks. There's almost no earnings growth underneath the surface.
Wow.
So then fast forward to 2025, there's expectations that the 493 starts to see faster earnings growth.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we'll have to see. Because yes, we're going to get a hit on the higher interest expense, and then we hope though that that can be mitigated by, an economy that's still growing and maybe faster revenue growth. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, one of the consequences of all this enormous amount of hyperscaler spending is these companies are capitalizing this expense. They're building in a higher level of depreciation expense for many years to come.
Oh, yeah.
So we should based with that being one of the factors, and if they don't see a big pickup in revenue to offset this continued robust level of spending, those seven stocks, now I know Tesla's within that, so you can sort of put that aside, but talking about like the hyperscaler names, including NVIDIA, their revenue growth rate, their earnings growth rate should shrink. How that merges together? Well, the market is obviously very optimistic here, and we'll have to see how that plays out. You know, the other thing with when it comes to the stock market, the hardest, maybe not the hardest, but one of the hardest things to do when you try to forecast where the stock market's going to go is trying to figure out is what is the right PE ratio to pay on that stream of earnings. And I do have to say, coming into this year, if you told me that, yes, okay, the Fed was going to cut interest rates this year, but across the yield curve, we would still have basically 4% plus interest rates, particularly on the long end, and the S&P 500 multiple would go from here to here. That was not on my guessing game card. But that's always the hardest thing. I mean, who can guess whether a PE ratio is going to go from 17 to 23? No one knows, and that's always the hardest thing. I think right now, though, you know, the challenge for the market is more of whether the multiple today can sustain itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's always the very big thing. Now, what can disrupt that multiple? What can get people to want to pay a lower one? Well, it's obviously if earnings don't meet expectations, but can it be this tariff war that sort of is more of a scattershot approach rather than very, you know, focused and selective? Can it be the 10-year yield that goes back to 5%, which I think is going to happen? I think we're still in a bond bear market, that after a 40-year bond bull market doesn't just end in a couple of years and boom, 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 we're back to, you know, lower rates forever type situation. I mean, right now, assuming the Fed cuts interest rates next week, rate cut expectations for 2025 are only like 200, twice and maybe 50% chance of a third. Mm-hmm. You know, higher for longer is not just a cliche now. It is for real. Yeah. And is this the right multiple in that sort of environment? Now, historically speaking, we know rates are actually somewhat normal. But after 15 years of zero, I don't think we've fully sort of acclimated to this higher rate environment relative to those prior 15 years. So I still think that there's, you know, it's not all clear sailing here.
Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with you. You know, you started the conversation, which is where I want to take a brief detour here on slide 36, Colin, with where are we in the valuation cycle and sort of what does that imply about investor positioning and investor sentiment? From our perspective, we're in a very asymmetric point in the valuation cycle through the lens of our positioning model, which tries to score, quite a few longer term time series through the context of how, where were they positioned or where were those time series? You know, what's the median value of those time series that we've observed historically at major bull market peaks or major bull market troughs? And, you know, we don't tell the model what to do, but the model is currently saying that the AI stock allocation is already exceeding the median value that is observed at major bull market peaks in the stock market going back the last 30, 40 years. The AI cash allocation survey is already exceeding the median value. S&P realized vol, which we use as a proxy for systematic fund exposure to the market, that's already exceeding the median value we observed at major bull market peaks. Same with implied vol correlations, which we use as a proxy for market neutral hedge fund exposure. Then we have that price to next 12 month earnings ratio in the 95th percentile of all time data going back to the late 80s. And then the investment grade credit spreads in the first percentile with data going back to the late 80s. So you think about this from the perspective of the positioning cycle, it's telling you that, okay, this isn't a catalyst for the market's momentum to reverse, but it is certainly
it's context.
Energy. It's potential energy. Exactly. This is, if the market does reverse momentum, it's telling you that it's probably going to reverse momentum in a very accelerated, aggressive fashion, a la 2018 or 2022 or something that looks a little bit more like, you know, 2015, 16, et cetera. You said something with respect to what could potentially cause this. You said two things, in my opinion. One, tariffs, and two, interest rates. Let's unpack the tariff box, and then we'll unpack the interest rate box, because I think the tariffs are fairly straightforward. I'd love to get your thoughts on that. And then we'll kind of spend more time on your view that interest rates are probably going to go back to 5%. So What's your take on the flow through from, okay, there's a tariff announcement or there's a tariff implementation to stocks potentially down meaningfully because we have multiple contraction? What's sort of the how do you connect the dots there?
So a couple things. So with tariffs, obviously, you know, we're going to focus on the Trump tariffs, and you know, Biden did nothing to take them off, and in fact, he added to them, particularly you know, with China and 100% tariffs on EVs. And today, he announced he's doubling the tariffs on solar panel materials and polysilicon and tungsten, I think it was also. So you know, both sides have come around to using tariffs. To me, right now, a couple things that I'm focused on here is, okay, from a person perspective, we have Jameson Greer, who is basically playing the role of Robert Lighthizer. He was his deputy trade rep. And from what I'm hearing, he's Lighthizer 2.0. And Trump just hired Peter Navarro. Those are two people that are very hawkish when it comes to tariffs. Oh. But how are they going to use tariffs? Or are they going to use tariffs like they did in 2017, 2018, where it's just sprayed out to a lot of different imports without rhyme or reason because they are just doing it to sort of come to an agreement in some fashion with China to try to get them to buy more corn and soybeans from us or whatever? Well, it didn't help lower the U.S. trade deficit. It sent U.S. manufacturing into recession. Nice. So are they going to be more thoughtful with that? I'm not sure. We'll have to see. Is it going to be really more focused on China and the ones on Canada and Mexico are just going to be veiled threats that they don't follow through on? Or here's the scenario that I'm most worried about, because I don't think this is priced into markets, is one of the key focuses right now of the House Ways and Means Committee and the economic team with Trump is extending those expiring 2025 at the year end tax cuts.
Totally.
And just through the budgeting rules, they have to come up with $4.5 trillion over 10 years of pay force, $450 billion a year. And we hope that DOGE is successful and we can find a bunch of spending cuts to sort of fill that gap. One of my fears, though, is that they use tariffs as a piggy bank just to claim tax revenues that we know American importers are actually paying.
Oh, yeah.
And they include that as tax pay-fors to offset the extension of the Trump tax cuts. That's the scenario that I would not be happy with, because that is not focused and selective. That is just, let's spray it out there. To me, tariffs, whether you agree with them or not, whether it's meant to encourage reshoring, whether it's trying to defend domestic industries like steel and aluminum, for example, whatever it is, it's mud in the gears of business. And for every benefit here, there's a negative here in terms of there's a user of that has to pay more for a particular raw material that, you know, a steel company would benefit from. So that's one thing that I'm focused on and worried about, that they use it, again, just as a piggy bank for this extension of the tax cuts.
Yeah, 100%.
So that, and also I forgot to mention the retaliation on us. You know, China is all ready for this. China was not ready in 2017. They are ready today. And nothing good comes out of this, but they're ready to tariff us back in points of our sort of supply chain that are not going to be well received here. So we got to be careful about this whole thing and even just the threats of it. I mean, if you're a small business with 25 employees and you're selling stuff to Walmart and you have no choice from a cost perspective to source your stuff from China, you are biting your nails every day right now.
Of course. I mean, look, and this is what the American voter base wanted, right? And so you're biting your nails, but there's really not much you can do about it in the context of how broad this governing mandate was for this incoming Trump administration. Colin, throw slide 90 here on the screen. This analysis is sourced from the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget. I think they take entirely too much flack from the world. I spent a whole day looking at all the different think tanks down in D.C. on budget matters, and they turn out to be, like, the based on my analysis, the one that was the least partisan, that had the most sort of bipartisan representation on their board and in their thought leadership. And you know, they're essentially saying that if you sort of listen to President Trump's tariff proposals on the campaign trail and aggregate them, they're essentially looking for roughly just shy of $3 trillion of pay-fors, of revenue from those tariffs to essentially offset the, you know, roughly $4 trillion of permanently extending the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So if they're going to use the budget reconciliation process to push through that tax cut, the permanent extension of that tax cut, they will have to find pay-fors, right? You can't extend the budget deficit beyond the 10-year window. And so what that ultimately means is that the market is probably under-assigning the probability and the size and scope of tariffs at the current juncture, which obviously represents a negative catalyst, certainly in the context of the positioning cycle dynamics we highlighted. And then specifically, the retaliation to me is one of the probably the least talked about, because I think there's more dot connecting to be done. And quite frankly, not many investors are qualified to connect these types of dots. But when you think about it from the perspective of, okay, how will China respond to this? Obviously, slapping on tariffs to U.S. exports is something that they can do. But China knows, and we know, and everyone knows that we don't really export that much stuff, right? What really matters is the how the Chinese yuan trades and how that's likely to contribute to the rest of the world. Colin, on slide 51 here from our leadoff morning note this morning, we show the experience, sort of the policy path that China took with respect to its currency policy in the face of, you know, the sort of previous Trump trade war. You know, we had a 13% depreciation of the yuan, devaluation of the yuan, from February of 18 through kind of September of 2019. And the rest of the world, obviously with China being the basically number one trading partner for pretty much every economy in the world, they're not going to sit there idly by and let China just, you know, siphon units of competitiveness from them. So they devalued too. And we had a 13% decline on an inverse DXY basis, you know, as well. So if the yuan declined 13%, we had the mean major currency versus the rest of the versus the U.S. dollar declined 13%, and the resulting dollar strength catalyzed a pretty significant decline on the S&P 500. We had a 20% decline in the S&P 500 in Q4 18. We had similar dynamics occur in the 2015-2016 yuan devaluation scenario, roughly around 12-13% decline in the Chinese yuan and the rest of the and the U.S.'s peer currencies versus the dollar. And we had a couple of back to back 14% declines in the S&P 500. So it's our view that we probably share your view, or this sounds like you have a developing view, that tariffs will probably be part of the policy prescription at the bare minimum as pay fors. They're probably going to be bigger than what's currently anticipated by market participants. And if that's correct, then it's our view, specifically my view, that we're probably going to see a significant depreciation of the yuan. That depreciation of yuan is probably going to cause the other peer currencies, you know, like the US or like the euro, the Japanese yen, the British pound, Swiss franc, et cetera, to also devalue their currencies versus the dollar. And then you wind up in this situation where you have, you know, a very aggressively strong U.S. dollar that is crowding out, you know, the international global capital markets, but also, you know, acting as a significant drag on U.S. corporate earnings. And so in my opinion, this is how you can have a significant re-rating lower of asset markets through the lens of tariffs, and not just because of the, you know, the stagflationary impact that tariffs impart upon the economy.
Yeah, you make some great points, and I'll add to them. So this morning I read Reuters had a report that, quoting some Chinese officials, that they would lean on a weaker yuan to mitigate the impact of tariffs. Now, I don't think that they want to have too weak of a yuan. I think they want to just sort of calibrate it just enough to help mitigate it. I don't think it's their policy to have a weak currency. I think they want a stable currency. But that's something that was out today that could lead to what you're saying. I think here's the inherent contradiction of wanting tariffs, but also wanting to have a strong U.S. manufacturing base. Is tariffs by definition tends to lead to a stronger currency.
Bingo.
And if you want, do you want to have tariffs because you want to reduce our trade deficit? But having a trade deficit in a way is why the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. So there are a lot of inherent conflicts with wanting to reshore, wanting to have a strong industrial base here that's cost competitive, wanting to have the dollar as the reserve currency. And so not all this squares up. One of the things that, and to your point about how a stronger dollar could impact corporate earnings, Oracle this week, you know, they're a multinational like anybody else that does a lot of business outside the U.S. And they said in their guide that I think the revenue number was going to be clipped by, I think it was 300 to 400 basis points, all because of FX. That's only going to continue if this level of dollar strength continues. Also to think about, and something that I'm going to be listening to in mid-January, late January into February as we get Q4 earnings, is not just the currency impact, but what if you have a lot of business in Europe? You know, Europe is not really seeing much growth at all. So if you have a weak euro, strong dollar, weak euro, and a weak European economy, what effect does that have on your earnings in that area of the world? So that's something that investors need to think about as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, think about the last two global corporate earnings recessions, you know, came in 2015, 16, and then they came in 2019, shortly after the, you know, resulting, you know, very aggressive up moves in the U.S. dollar. So, you know, these are underappreciated risks that I think will become more appreciated as we move forward in time. You know, trying to time this stuff in terms of when to put on the trades or take off certain trades, I think that's a separate part of our process. And I think it sounds like it's a separate part of your process as well. I want to pivot and end the conversation on something you said earlier that I don't think is consensus anymore. Quite frankly, I'm not sure if it was ever truly consensus, but you certainly had folks like our friend Jim Bianco over at Bianco Research and others who pounding the table that, you know, the bond market is probably underpricing, you know, in our opinion, structural tailwinds for both supply and inflation. And you made the comment that you think the 10-year is headed back towards 5%. Can we unpack that?
Sure. So when I stretch out, call it the last, you know, post GFC and, you know, the era of zero rates, negative rates, QE, and so on, and you look at that time frame and you're like, okay, where were the excesses that that type of policy created? And to me, that real excess was in sovereign debt. And when we had $18 trillion of negative yielding securities a couple of years ago, on a dollar basis, it was probably the biggest financial bubble in the history of bubbles.
Right.
And then, of course, you throw inflation into that epic bubble, and you have this big increase in interest rates in a very rapid period of time. And I just don't think that sort of unwind is over. I still think there's more to come. And then you ask, okay, well, what would be the catalyst? Is it just, you know, a growth in inflation analysis? And if inflation is going to act like the 1970s, it goes up, it comes down, it goes back up again. Is that one of the reasons? Maybe could be. Could it be growth that hangs in there? Yeah, that could be too, which would imply that the Fed would not cut interest rates too much. And that would basically put a floor under interest rates. Could it be that investors finally care about the global debt levels at the sovereign level? Do U.S. debts and deficits finally matter? Well, when I look at gold nearing 2,800, while the dollar is ripping higher, that tells me yes. Right. Gold is now ripping against the U.S. dollar, just as the dollar is ripping against other currencies. And that tells me that there's issues that people have with sovereign debt, because a lot of that money flowing into gold is from central banks who have the choice of, do I want to own gold? Do I want to own JGBs? Do I want to own German bunds or French oats or U.S. treasuries? And a lot of them are choosing gold as another asset. And that's been obviously going on for years. We know also post the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But debts and deficits, I believe, do matter. And we saw that recently in the UK when there was initial pushback against Rachel Reeves' budget and the gilt yield spiked on that. We've seen that in France, even though French oat yields are still relatively low. We obviously have seen a gap out relative to German bund yields. So I think that the 5% level in the 10-year could be reached, yes, because inflation could be bottoming out. If inflation accelerates again, we can get there. Growth can hang in, we can get there. But sovereign accidents can also get us there too, because the French government's being put on notice. What your budget looks like is going to matter for us. Same in the UK, and I do believe the same in the US. And so we can maybe get to 5%, not because, okay, the economy is great, but for not necessarily good reason.
No, 100%. I think slide 93 is exactly the chart to show for the quote unquote not necessarily good reason aspect of that. In this chart, we show the term 10-year term premium on the 10-year tenor. And for those who may be unfamiliar, term premium is the excess return you get for rolling over short-term treasuries instead of taking illiquidity risk at various points of the curve. And so term premium on the 10-year tenor is currently 9 basis points, essentially zero. If you go back and you study this time series all the way back to the early 60s, which as far as we have the time series for, you know, the mean term premium for the 10 years is 150 basis points. And that makes sense. There should be a unit of excess return you pick up as an investor for taking on illiquidity risk, right? And that's exactly what the term premium market is essentially suggesting, that you're not getting paid, you're not getting compensated for that additional risk. And part of the reason you're not getting compensated, obviously, we have the asymmetrically dovish Fed. We have decades of, or you know, decade plus of expansionary balance sheet policy by the Fed, which has removed a lot of supply from the market at a time where, if you look forward in time, the incremental supply that's going to be hitting the Treasury market is at an all-time high at an accelerating rate. And so we did an intellectual kind of a thought leadership exercise to say, okay, if we add, we adjust the 10-year Treasury yield for the deviation from the mean and the long-term mean and term premia, you know, what would the 10-year Treasury yield be? It'd actually be somewhere close to 5.6%, Peter. And if you actually use the 5.6% nominal 10-year Treasury yield and try to determine inflation compensation from that, you know, by subtracting the TIPS yield, you'd wind up with a 3.69% a 10-year break-even rate. To me, those numbers feel a lot more, they make a lot more sense in the context of the U.S.'s very aggressive fiscal outlook, which in our opinion, based on our forthcoming analysis, you know, we did a big dive empirical study on what happens to monetary fiscal policy in a fourth turning, how those things impact the economy and asset markets. You know, one of the key takeaways is that you typically see explosive growth in sovereign deficits and debt, well beyond any sort of, you know, reasonable projections would be able to articulate. And so in our belief, you know, when you add back the term premium to bond market, the bond market is appropriately pricing in these risks, the risk for upside tailwinds for supply and inflation. But it's not currently pricing that in you know, when you actually look at the market. And so to me, this represents a significant market risk. We don't have to get there overnight. There's going to be obviously catalysts to get us there from the perspective of, you know, what's likely to become, you know, a very obvious sticky level of inflation in 2025. We think the resiliency of the economy is likely to persist into 2025, but only getting slightly less resilient as the labor market slows down, as a function of immigration policy, the economy slows down as a function of tariffs, and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think we share your view, your longer term view, that the bond market is mispriced and the pricing is lower in price and higher in yield.
Yeah, no, you make all great points. And the 5% was really just a retest of where we were last summer that can definitely blow through that if for not good reason. Those not good reasons happen. And you lay out definitely a bunch of them.
100%, man. Well, Peter, this has been a fantastic conversation, man. I'm really grateful that you joined us. You have a very calm demeanor about you, which tells me you've seen cycles. And I appreciate that about you. I find that, you know, I learn the most when I'm talking to folks with gray hair. I'm starting to get a couple myself in this business. I don't think you can do this job well managing risk as an investor well without having seen cycles, without having the, you know, sort of, you know, kind of the emotional discipline it takes. And that obviously comes with age. So I just want to appreciate your insights, man. Thank you. Where can we send folks to come find you?
Well, thanks, Darius. So it was a pleasure being on. And I'm sure if we had the time, we can probably speak for another couple of hours on this stuff. So I write daily on Substack. People can just search my name and see it. It's called The Book Report. It was a play on my last name. And on the wealth management side, Bleakley Financial Group, our website's bleakley.com if anybody is interested in learning more about us.
Absolutely, my friend. And just before I even let you go, what's the genesis of the last name? That's an interesting last name.
So it's Russian, and Bukvar means reading tablet in Russian.
I love that.
Goes way back. I've never been there, but that's the derivation.
I love it. I love it. So my name will be Darius Kendall in 2025, I guess. Well, look, man, I appreciate you for coming on, man. Happy holidays to you and your family. And
thanks, you too. Appreciate having me on.
Your clients. Cheers, brother.
Disclaimer, 42 Macro does not provide, and no portion of our content purports to be, individualized or specific investment advice. And 42 Macro does not provide investment advice to individuals. All information provided by 42 Macro is general in nature and is made without regard to individual levels of sophistication or investment experience, investment preferences, objectives, or risk parameters, and without regard to the suitability of the content for individuals or entities who may access it. No information provided by 42 Macro should be construed as an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor should it be construed as tailored or specific to you or consumer thereof. You understand and agree that our content does not constitute specific recommendations of any particular investment, security, portfolio, transaction, or strategy, nor does it recommend any specific course of action is suitable for any specific person or entity or group of persons or entities. At any point in time, the employees of 42 Macro may own a portion of or all the ETF securities discussed in 42 Macro Research content. 42 Macro Research content is based upon information from sources believed to be reliable. 42 Macro is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information, nor is it responsible for the accuracy or authenticity of the information upon which it relies.